Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women. Gorgeous food and drink on Radio Gorgeous. Lindsay Barham is a name you should all recognise as the food writer whose recipes you can really cook. Lindsay started out as a restaurant critic and food writer on London's Time Out magazine. She's a prolific author of cookery books. I counted 15 on her Amazon page. I got to know Lindsay's friendly, relaxed style when I followed her recipes when she had her daily column in the Evening Standard. I still make a spring salad with mini vegetables with Dijon and bacon.
Send that to me and I can use it again.
Yeah. Lindsay, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me to join you.
Now, first of all, we're going to talk about One Pot, okay, which is the book that's out at the moment. Now, when I think of one pot cooking, it's a winter thing. So tell me some springy summer recipes in your book.
Well, it's the whole point about this book is I didn't want it to be just a kind of stew. As you say, it's what you think of when you think of one pot. I wanted to extend the brief and turn it into lots of different ways of cooking in one pot or one dish or one pan. And so it goes from fry-ups through bakes and salads to stews, obviously, to pasta and noodles, rice, and of course puddings, because there are lots of puddings you can do in one pot, curries. What else have we got here? I've got big soups.
I've got the soup book.
Have you?
Yeah, and that is my soup's my big thing. So it's so well leafed. I have read it.
Excellent,
so many times.
Excellent. I find myself more and more doing things like this, which is I've called it Szechuan chicken salad with peanut and sesame, and it's basically a variation on bang bang chicken. You know that dish you get in a lot of Chinese restaurants, and I think it's using leftovers and it's being creative and a bit, you know, making a salad into a main meal. So there's a whole chunk of those.
That's really good because we all want to eat salad.
Exactly. And using a little bit of fish or meat or chicken with a lot of vegetables, a lot of lentil things, a lot of noodle things.
Well, that's the thing. Your food is not English.
I mean, well, I think it's my heritage as a restaurant critic, which I did for about 15 years. And everyone always thinks, oh God, what a marvellous job, you know. But you're not eating at the Woolsey every night. You know, you are darting all over London as a London critic, which I was for Time Out all those years. And you're trying out all sorts of different things. And whenever I had anything that I liked, I asked or found out how to make it, and then I made it. And I went on from there. And all the while, I started reviewing cookbooks and buying cookbooks. I discovered Books for Cooks in Notting Hill, which is just, I mean, I've got a mini Books for Cooks here now. I've got thousands of my own cookbooks. And I've just, you know, experimented. And being a kind of a greedy person living on a shoestring, as I was when I started out, you know, just trying to make good, tasty food for young boys, you know, who have huge appetites.
Was this in the 80s you're a food critic?
I joined Time Out in the early 70s when it went from being a broadsheet into a little magazine, and then I came in at around the time when it was a big glossy magazine, being started at King's Cross we were. And I started doing the sellout section, which was the consumer section, which I had to become an expert on anything to do with living in London that's not entertainment. So if you wanted to sand your floors, or you wanted to buy a cheap alternative to lino, or you wanted to hire a TV, which we did in those days, or you wanted to almost anything.
Kind of practical things.
Practical stuff. Yeah. I became an expert. And then I wrote about it in a way that made it accessible to anybody who's not normally interested in reading about, you know.
Yeah, something as unglamorous as
that. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I have to say that when I finished doing it, I was very relieved that I didn't have to, you know, do that anymore.
Because I'm interested to know about restaurants in the 70s in London.
Well, at Time Out really started the Lonely Hearts ads. Mm-hmm. And to begin with, I used to work down on the ground floor. and the ad department was on the ground floor. And you would see these people coming in and putting ads in. And also we had a number of restaurants taking small ads, you know, not proper big ads, just little ads. Mm-hmm. And we devised this thing, which an awful lot of magazines and newspapers used to do. I don't know if they still do it, which is if you advertise, the magazine gets a free meal. And then then they get a review in exchange. Mm-hmm. So it's all this kind of lovely, impartial...
So you must have gone to some quite bizarre places.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And a lot of places that have come and gone.
Yeah.
But then, you know, a few years went by and I ceased to be so interested in the sellout side of things and more interested in the food side of things. And we had an editor called Richard Williams, who then went to The Times and then went to The Guardian, and he's now just got his own blog going on. He's a sport and music person. And he'd obviously, as he came in as editor, was looking at the whole magazine and seeing how things could be chivvied up. And he asked me if I would take on the restaurant section and do it properly. So that meant goodbye to free meals and going and being an impartial reviewer. I loved it.
Did they recognise you?
No. They didn't know me at all. Yeah. And then, you know, time went by and I edited both. I had my children in the fullness of time, my two sons. And so I had an assistant and all the time reviewing at restaurants.
Because you're terribly slim. Did you put on weight?
Well, I always thought that my two sons are probably the best nourished babies ever because, you know, they ate out with me in my tummy and then with me. And they've become very good cooks, natural cooks.
Wow.
But I think, you know, when you're cooking, I don't know. For me, I mean, I'm tasting all the time. I eat a lot of things on toast because I'm, you know...
Quickly.
And I have a dog that you've met. So I'm very active. Yeah. And
you do look so fabulous.
Oh, thank you very much. And so I keep active. I eat healthily and well. I'm conscious of what I'm... Probably look well because I'm coming to the end of Lent and I've been on the wagon for Lent.
Oh, well done!
I know, it's stunning,
good,
isn't it?
Because I've realised it's a long time.
It's a bloody
what
long time.
What is it, nearly 3 months?
No, 40 days, isn't it? 40 nights in the wilderness.
Well, it's a very big wilderness.
I know. Actually, I'm starting to break it. I had a glass of wine last night. And, you know, you have a completely different relationship. I know it'll very quickly break down again and I'll be back to my usual enormous amount of white wine.
And just intrigued to know, was it sort of like vegetarian restaurants? What was it in the 70s?
There were Indian vegetarian restaurants, some of which are still going now in Drummond Street. Yeah. They were quite funky and still are, I think. There were, you know, kind of quite hippie places.
And like the Cranks, the beginning of Cranks.
There was the beginning of Cranks.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
there was all that simmering up.
Brown rice. Around.
Brown rice.
Yeah. There must have been places as well which did very rich.
The burger. The burgers was just starting then.
Wow.
Yeah, the Hard Rock was just opening.
Wow,
then.
That's amazing.
And other places like Parsons in Fulham Road.
Yeah.
The Great American Disaster. All these burger joints.
Yeah.
And you've got bistros.
Yes, bistros.
You've got the remnants of 60s. London, you know, with little kind of brasserie bistros. In fact, brasseries came a bit later.
I think they swept London, more 80s.
Well, there were a lot of really awful places, you know, really terrible. And the Chinese and the Indian places. I mean, Chinatown, you had to go to Chinatown if you wanted some decent Chinese dim sum. And it was all very alien and quite sort of I had a Chinese friend who introduced me to Chinese food. There were a lot of very mediocre places there were French restaurants in inverted commas, you know. It was posh or very modest.
Yeah.
There wasn't much in the middle, which of course there is so much of now.
Yeah, exactly. Now it's totally, everything is catering for the middle market, isn't it? You know, think of all the chains. I mean,
There was the Spaghetti House. Do you remember the Spaghetti House? Yeah. That was going, Pizza Express started around that time.
Yeah.
What? So pizza was just starting to happen.
So you weren't a cook then?
No, I wasn't a cook, but I was teaching myself to cook. I had always loved food. I'd come to London thinking I couldn't boil an egg, but in fact, you soon find out that there's all sorts of things you can do because you've almost by osmosis, by watching your mum, you know, in my case, being asked to make the pastry for the inevitable apple pie at the weekend and, you know, stir this, do that,
so
buy
that. So your mum could cook then?
My mother, yeah. I'm one of four. So she was cooking for six every day.
Wow.
Poor thing.
Gosh. And those were days when you really had to cook.
Yeah, you cooked everything from scratch. There was no such thing as chicken portions or, you know, frozen peas was about as convenient as it got. Yeah. And actually they were tinned, weren't they? Garden peas in a tin. So, you know, there was a lot of cooking going on, but I didn't really...
You weren't conscious.
No, and it wasn't when we were... When I was about 12, 13 or something, we started going on camping holidays to France. And then I saw food as a thing of beauty. You know, I can remember seeing the way the fruit was piled up in the shops. Just a completely different experience, you know.
And a load of cabbages in England.
Yeah, exactly. Cabbages and carrots and onions, you know. It was peaches and melons and, you know, it was just so evocative. And it just sort of made your fingers itch, you know, to get your hands on it. And, you know, so that was my beginning. When I was about 17, I went hitchhiking with my brother in France, and basically there's a whole story to it which one day I'm going to write, but I was left in the mountains in a youth hostel while he went off to try and get some money so that we could go on with our journey to where we were supposed to be.
You'd run out, basically.
Exactly. And so I lived in this youth hostel, and they grew all their own fruit and veg for the meals, and it was just transformed my whole approach to preparing, you know, sort of having an artichoke. I mean, I just didn't know what you did.
No.
You know, I just watched.
Where
and
was that
learned.
In the mountains?
It was a place called Giest near Briançon.
Lovely.
Yeah, it was. It was absolutely, one day I'll go
so
back.
So that literally opened your mind going there.
Yeah. So that was the start probably, but it was, you know, way before I actually left home and life kicked in. When I first moved to London, we lived on Fray Bentos pies, and you know, we didn't really know how to make food.
No,
you know.
Well, I learned to cook by I got married in the 90s and then realized I've got to start cooking. And it was your column in the Evening Standard.
Oh, well, that's fantastic,
because it was easy and I could always read it and I could get hold of ingredients.
Yeah, well, that was the plan, and I do something similar in the Times. And it's the same thing, you know, it's after work.
Yeah, I can't bear it when you look at a recipe and you think, oh no, it's something really obscure. I've got to order that on the internet or go to some weird Turkish place and get it, you know. Yeah. Whereas you always say things like, if you can't get it, you can use this instead.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. I mean, it's always been... I can remember one of my sons when he was about 12, you know, came home from school and he's standing in front of the fridge, sort of staring into this fridge that, as far as I'm concerned, is piled with food.
Yeah.
And he's sort of, you know, and he says, nothing to eat in this house. And what he meant was, you know, where's the ready-made pizza?
Yeah.
Where's the instant meal, you know, that all his friends had? So, you know.
So you've written 15 cookbooks.
Yeah.
You also worked with Simon Hopkinson.
I did.
Who wrote the very famous book, Roast Chicken.
Yeah, which I helped him write in this very
you
house.
Helped him write?
In this very house.
Why did he need you?
Well, what happened was I'd written the potato book, but I'd come to know Simon and an awful lot of other chefs through being a restaurant critic. And I used to do this column where I would take someone like Simon out to lunch to a restaurant of their choice and interview them about their favourite restaurants. And then I could write about them, why they liked, you know, such and such a restaurant, what they always ordered when they went there, with a listing at the end. And it's
fabulous.
A really good...
Yeah,
you know,
I want to read it.
Yeah, exactly. And Simon became quite a good friend. And we're having a drink in the Groucho one night. And my youngest son was quite little and he's sitting under the seat playing with his micro cars. And Simon's telling me about the fact that Jill Norman, who was Elizabeth David's editor for a long time, had asked him to do this book and how he'd started it, but he just couldn't get on with it. You know, he couldn't get going on it and he was too busy. And I said, well, you've got to, you know, we love your food. We want your recipes. If necessary, I'll help you. And that's basically what happened. And he used to come here three sessions a week and we would go away. I would rent cottages hither and yon. And, you know, we would work together. You know, sometimes he'd be in a terrible state and he'd have to just turn around and go back because we didn't know it at the time, but he was coming to the end of wanting to be a chef of his, you know, he's a perfectionist and wow. he wants everything done to an incredible standard. Mm-hmm. And he felt that he was losing his ability to make all that happen and be comfortable with it. You know, sometimes I'd say, well, just talk to me, Simon, just tell yeah. me, you know, and then, you know, I'd get it all down. And then when he'd gone, I'd turn it into prose and, you know, we'd cook here. And so that's how Roast Chicken and Other Stories happened. And while we were doing it, we started talking about recipes, as we called them, that we've loved and lost. And that ended up being the Prawn Cocktail Years, which is all
now,
those,
that is a great title.
It's a good title, isn't it? It's yeah. all those dishes from all those different eras, you know, like the Trat era in the 70s. That's another type of Italian food that we didn't touch on before. You know, the continental restaurant, the gentleman's club, you know, the bistro, 60s bistro, all these different categories with favourite recipes. And we did that together. So
fun. What fun.
To survive. Daddy lied. Mama cried. Things I never learned in school. Yes, I found out all too soon. Mama didn't raise no fool. Feel alone. Daddy's gone. Didn't ask for this. Broken home. Yeah, the rumors got it true. Could have easily been you. Mama didn't raise no fool.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com.
You've written 15 books. Mm. I'm sitting in a pile of books, by the way. It's quite uncomfortable. But yeah. I am in Lindsay's kitchen, which is very nice, on a sofa. But well, she has put about 10 books on top of me. Okay.
Well, as things do, when the Evening Standard came to an end, there was a new editor. I've been doing it for 8 years. A new editor came in and she thought it was old-fashioned to have a daily recipe and gave such me rubbish. My marching orders. Yeah. Yeah. And I had been renting from my ex-husband the house that he grew up in Cornwall, in a fishing village called Mousel. And it had become a means for us to become friends again, which was wonderful. So I'd had the luxury of two homes buzzing up and down to Cornwall for 4 years. And then, you know, I went from being a very highly paid person to an no income whatsoever. Oh. My sons were at college by then,
thankfully.
And I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And a girlfriend said to me, well, why don't you write about the fish store? And basically, that's what I did. I just moved down to London and just sat down there for 6 months writing this book. I wrote all these chapters at the beginning of the book about Mousel and my relationship with the fish store and how I came to be there. And, you know, fully expecting that when I gave in the manuscript, the editor, we said, we don't want all this, you know, self-indulgent tosh. But actually, she loved it. And, you know, there's all the categories in the book, all the chapters are to do with food that's in Cornwall. So
why is it called the fish store then?
Because the house is called the fish store. Oh, it's somewhere that...
It was a fish store.
Yeah, it was my in-laws bought it in 1939. They were living in Paris. He was an artist. And the idea was to set up an art school in Mousel. It was an old industrial building. They got the builder to cut the corner off and it was turned into a three-bedroom flat with same space downstairs where the fish used to be put in great big pits, baths, whatever you want to call it, concrete things with salt. And then when they were salted, they were taken upstairs. This is pilchards. Mm-hmm. When pilchards were, apparently you could almost walk across the sea. There were so many pilchards.
Wow.
And then they would be gutted and washed and pressed with these great big lodestones to, and then the oil collected. So that's what they bought. And they turned it into this home and a studio for Edwin. And so that was the fish door.
Is it a comfortable place to live?
Absolutely fabulous. And you look out to the sea, you can see the harbour from the window.
Mm-hmm. So they used to bring the fish up then?
Yeah, but that was a long time ago. The fishing boats actually went into Newlyn, which is the next village. You know, you still get people that catch a few mackerel or herring, you know, or who have crab pots. But essentially, in the next village, there's a big market, fish market.
Wow,
Newlyn,
so
is one of the big fish
markets.
Yeah. So that's what I wrote about. And I wrote, you know, about all the different sorts of fish, about the crab, the lobster, about the vegetables you get down there, the wonderful potatoes, the cauliflowers and the broccoli.
Now, what I want to ask is, are you cooking while you write?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yes. I'm down there and I'm cooking. And what I did was I was in the glums because, you know, I was in a terrible black hole. Mm. And also I'm thinking, I can't write this book. It's not my story. You know, it's Ben's story. It's not my story. And then I had to keep bringing myself back round to the fact that actually I'm writing about my relationship with it. So I've got to make it my story. I've got to see a way to do that. And I was interviewing all the people I'd come to know in the village, you know, that I'd been going to for a long time. And Ben's mother used to still live there when I first started going there. We would visit her and the house became Ben's and then I was renting it. It now belongs to our two sons.
Oh, wow. What a fantastic thing to inherit.
You know, so in the morning I would get up and I would sit with my computer looking out of the window. And there is, in fact, a chapter called Looking Out of the Window or something like that. Because I would just write what I saw just to get myself going. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's just absolutely amazing what you do see, you know, the fishing boats coming in and out, the gulls, the way the water changes, you know, the sea. I mean, it doesn't sound much, but there's a lot to say, actually.
Yeah. How did you hone the recipes then to go in this one?
Well, all the recipes are things that I have cooked, or Betty, Ben's mum, cooked at the fish store, you know, from fish pie, from how to pick a crab to, you know, dealing with mackerel and all the different varieties.
Yeah, because I am scared of cooking fish.
I know, a lot of people with reason, you know. Mm. I mean, once you know a few basic things, it's actually very easy because fish cooks so quickly. It's a very convenient thing to cook, actually.
A good supper dish.
Yeah, and can be very inexpensive.
Yes, again, because you go for mackerel.
Yeah, or herring.
Are herrings kippers, or are kippers herrings?
Yes, they are, actually. Yes, they are. They've been smoked. Yeah,
okay.
Okay. They're all oily fish, you know, from sprats right up to mackerel.
Mm-hmm. So they're all very good for you, then.
Yeah, all very good for you. Mm. And pilchards are large sardines, basically.
Which, really?
That's what they are.
Yeah. We're secretly large sardines, but we've called ourselves another name just to muddle people up.
Well, pilchards is rather a sort of down-market name, isn't it?
For
it was so plentiful.
But we think of
and
tins,
we put it in tins.
Do
you know, it's one of the few things that I cannot eat is pilchards in a tomato sauce in a tin. Over the years, I have tried so many times and it's just instant gut rot for me. I don't know what it is. It's some kind of
That's a shame. You could have said, you know, it's
such
a shame.
Yeah.
But let's go on to some other books then that you've written.
My first book was called In Praise of the Potato, and that was I had lost my job at Time Out. My whole life combusted. My marriage broke up. I lost my job at Time Out. I had two sons under six. A very acrimonious split, no money coming in, nothing. And I'd met a woman who was an editor at Michael Joseph, which is part of Penguin. And she came for a drink with a male friend and ended up staying for supper and afterwards wrote me a letter saying, if you ever want to do a book, please let me know. You know, I hadn't even thought that that might be on the cards. I was a restaurant critic as far as I was concerned.
Yes.
And so when the time came that I needed to earn some money, I contacted her and said, were you serious? And she said, yes. And I thought, what on earth can I write a cookbook about?
Yeah, yeah.
And I started looking through my restaurant review cuttings and noticed that I always picked up on potato dishes. And we were so skint, we were living on baked potatoes, potato soups, curried potatoes. And I thought, So I wrote a synopsis for a book that was In Praise of the Potato, and that was my first cookbook.
No one must have done that before. I mean, it
well,
must have been
totally one or two original. People had done it actually, but the way I did it was original. And then I did one on the Onion family. Well, I did one on soups, the one that you
yes.
Read. That was my next one. And then I'd started doing the Onion family by then.
Onions the Onion
without...
family?
Yeah.
I suppose
yeah.
There's leeks.
Yeah.
There's red onions, white onions.
Spring onions.
Yeah.
Chives.
Yeah.
So there's quite a few of them. Garlic.
It's really good fun doing it that way, isn't it?
Well, actually, I wish I'd just stuck with onions, actually, because there's too much,
yes,
you know,
yes.
and it just floored me in the end,
yeah.
You know. It could have gone on forever.
But hang on, but this is the big red book about tomatoes.
Yeah, about 400 recipes for tomato. And, you know, I could probably do another book the same size, because the thing is that you just scratch the surface, and I become obsessive when I do these single subject books. You know, I want everything. You know, I want the 10 different ways that you can do a cream of tomato soup, but you can't
yes.
Because you just have to pick one.
I've noticed that you do different ways of doing things.
Yeah.
That's like a traditional cookbook. That's what I've got, you know, my mum's Constant Spry cookbook
yes.
And that,
yes.
You know. She'd take something and say, look, there's loads of different ways of doing
of course.
This. And that's much more fun, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And it's much more interesting to write as well. And also, I tell you something else. I did so much research for all these single subject books. I could see who the plagiarists are as well. You know,
yes.
You can see who's just sort of
yeah. Oh, I recognize
done that,
that
and done
yeah,
that
yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Called it their own
yeah,
and not actually
that.
Cooked it.
Yeah.
I always say, you know, this is... I mean, I know why people don't, because editors, there's only so many recipes, you know, and you can cook away until the cows come home. But, you know, so many people end up doing the same or similar things, you know.
Yes,
that
especially
is...
fashions, as we know. Food is so much about fashion, isn't it?
Interestingly.
Now, yeah,
I mean, it shouldn't
yeah.
be, but mm. it's sort of, you know, things, different grains become fashionable.
Exactly.
It was lentils.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's... Frika. Have you come across that?
Not yet.
No. Well, that's
tell me about Frika.
That's
good name.
It's a bit like bulgur.
Yeah.
It's a cracked wheat basically,
mm.
And you know, you use it in the same way. It's a bit like couscous. It's
no,
one
I've
of those
never
sort
known
of
what
things.
To do with cracked wheat. Can you tell me quickly what to do?
Well,
with it?
I've actually I'm preparing
yes.
a salad to show you
well,
exactly
go,
what you
let's
can
go
do.
Let's go do that now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is a recipe. Sorry.
See, I
that's
said I'll
some of the books falling down.
Yeah.
This is a recipe from
okay.
The One Pot Wonders
yeah.
book, and it's just showing you that one pot can be so versatile.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, what I've done is I've made some little chicken kebabs, and you're cooking those. So that's your one pot. That's
mm-hmm.
using one. You know, you could do it in a frying pan, or you could do it on a griddle. You're making a great big salad that's got bulgur. And there it is.
Yeah.
And it's just soaked in boiling water.
Now,
covered.
How long do you soak it for?
About 30 minutes.
So it's just
absolute
like couscous.
Max. It's a bit like couscous.
Yeah.
Important to wash it thoroughly before you start.
Mm.
And then I've chopped up some shallots, which I put in the bowl
yeah.
with a bit of lemon juice. I've made a dressing with orange juice and lemon juice, olive
really...
oil.
It's very aromatic, yeah.
Some chopped up mint and parsley and watercress and cherry tomatoes. And then just mix it all together.
Yeah.
And so you end up with something that's really very pretty and very satisfying, actually, because you've got that cracked wheat in there, the bulgur.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then my idea is to... You serve your little kebabs
yeah.
with some of the... Some of the salad in a curl of lettuce like that.
Yes.
So it looks so pretty.
Yeah.
So there you are. That's
it's
a
really
different
simple.
Sort of one pot.
That is so simple. Mm. It's brilliant. And you could do that with kind of any other kind of, like you say, cracked wheat or couscous or anything.
Yeah, well, that is the bulgur cracked wheat. You could do it with frika, which, is, as we said, is our new favourite type of thing.
Right.
Yeah, or you could do it with couscous. It's giving you an alternative to potatoes or pasta or noodles or rice
or
and it's giving you a lovely salad, so you've got lots of your.
I'd say that's kind of quite Middle Eastern.
Yes,
you?
Yes,
yeah.
definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you could serve that with some hummus, which is in one of my books. Probably more than one.
Gosh.
And you know, with olive oil, absolutely delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. That is very easy to make, isn't it?
Stunningly easy. I once timed myself making it. It takes 6 minutes. The quick way to do it is to use a can of chickpeas, which you drain, and then you put them in a food processor with a couple of cloves of garlic, salt, pepper, juice of a lemon. I put in a little bit of cumin, and sometimes I put sesame, pounded sesame, tahini in as well if I've got some. Mm-hmm. Don't have to. A tablespoon of olive oil, bit of the liquid from the chickpeas were in from the tin, and then you pulse it to get it all kind of chopped up, and then while it's going around you just pour more olive oil in and maybe a bit of water until you get the consistency you want, and that's job done.
Well, that is beautiful hummus, because whenever I make it, mine is full of lumps.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I go into it in the trifle bowl about a lovely lady called Anissa Halou, who is a Lebanese cook and cookery writer. She told me that the way to get super smooth hummus is to rub the chickpeas between your hands to get all that very thin skin off them.
Yes.
And I mean, the skin multiplies. You end up with a sink full of these little papery skins, but you get the most beautiful hummus.
Wow.
I mean, once in a blue moon, it's worth doing that.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a pain
especially
in the butt, to be honest.
If you've done them from...
Yeah, if you boiled them from scratch.
Exactly.
I mean, it is a pain in the butt, but it is fabulous.
I might try that one day.
Here's another slightly different pasta dish, actually. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that follow my column in The Times are wheat intolerant. So this is using spelt, pasta made with spelt, flavoured with spinach.
Mm-hmm.
So I use that.
What make is that, just so people
it's,
can find it?
Biona.
Okay.
B-I-O-N-A.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can get it from any health food shop.
Yeah.
So you cook that up. And it's a lovely way of using a small amount of asparagus.
Which is in season
Which
now.
Has just come into season.
Yeah.
So you cook that up. Mm. You fry some torn bits of cured ham. You know, I've used San Daniele, but anything like prosciutto or serrano ham. Mm-hmm. You don't need that much.
Mm-hmm.
Some little cubes of goat cheese or feta.
Mm.
And so you cook the pasta, fry up the little bits of ham so they get crispy.
Yeah.
And then you've cooked the asparagus and then you toss it all together and then you get this sort of gorgeous, very simple dish.
God,
and the
delicious.
Cheese sort of melts and makes a sort of creamy sauce with the pasta. So
I can just imagine the crunchiness of the kind of...
Yeah, the ham. Yeah, the
prosciutto. With the asparagus.
Yes.
Oh my God, that'd be so good.
And I've got one more I've got to...
Yeah.
So showing...
Yes,
you know,
please.
I can show
this
you.
Is fabulous.
Now, this is typical of how I get my ideas. Mm-hmm. I went to a cookery demonstration by a Korean chef, and he did this dish, which I then promptly adapted and made it quick and easy. And basically, it's you make a sauce. You can see it's this kind of taupe colour, which is... Let's see if you can tell me what it is. You're never going to guess, actually.
It's something fruity, I'd say.
Yeah, it is. It's pear and soy sauce. It's tinned pears and soy sauce. You could use fresh pears, but... And that's liquidized with a bit of stock. And then you cook chicken in that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add boiled potatoes, which for one pot wonder you have boiled beforehand in the pan before you start cooking the sauce
incredible.
And the chicken, and then you serve it with beans on the top, and it just
fabulous.
Looks stunningly pretty.
Yeah.
And you've got your greens and you've got a one pot
meal. But also you've got something that you've never tasted before.
Exactly.
I've never tasted that taste before.
No, and it's really
beautiful.
Delicious, really interesting, and definitely a talking point.
Yes. Now, so do they cook with fruit a lot in Korea? Did you find that out?
I don't think so, especially. Mm. I mean, that's the way they do it is with short ribs, and it cooks sort of all day, you know, until...
See, this is the clever Lindsay Barron way. You're so clever, everything you do. So let's just go back and just talk about the trifle bowl.
Yes.
Now, the trifle bowl, it's... tell us about it, because I have a trifle bowl at home, and it was my granny's bowl.
Well, so was mine. I was sitting here on this sofa where we are, and I just got my dog that you've met, Red. We've just been out for a walk. It's pouring with rain. There's rain sort of outside. There's rain all over me, all over the dog.
Yes.
And I had Desert Island Discs on, and I'm just sort of looking around my kitchen like you do, thinking, you know, I really want to do a book that is about my life as a cook in this house, because I bought it in 1988. We moved in 1989 and brought up my sons here, basically. And there are many meals that have been cooked here, and, you know, parties that have been had, and there are lots of stories. And the whole place, as you can see, is stuffed with...
I can't believe how many pots you've got. I mean...
pots and pans.
The terracotta pots, I can count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14 terracotta. Then you've got the, like, Le Creuset types. Yeah. You've got 2, 4, 5, 6. I mean, unbelievable. But it doesn't look cluttered,
no.
Strangely. You've got...
Well, I've got cupboards as well. Yeah. So then I sort of looked up there and my eyes sort of rested on what is my grandmother's trifle bowl. And I started thinking about how, you know, every Boxing Day we would drive down, you know, the six of us down to my mother's sister, who also had four children. So there'd be kind of like 12, 13 or something of us all sort of sitting around having... There were two trifle bowls.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, having trifles and on Boxing Day for pudding, like you do or did. And, you know, I just started remembering all these things and I thought, that's it. So this is how I did this book.
It's beautiful,
this
book.
Plate here was made by one of my aunts.
So it's beautiful. It's got gold leaf on it.
Yeah, it's got gold.
It?
Yeah, she was an art mistress. She had a big thing about glazes, pottery glazes.
Oh,
and that's
stunning.
She
that's
won a competition with
beautiful
her.
Fig dish.
Yeah,
it?
That's a fig tarte tatin. I always cook it in this little Le Creuset frying pan. So I talk about that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the book, it's an unusual way of ordering a cookbook, and some people think it's a barking mad idea.
Yes, but other, all the best ones are, aren't they?
But other people really like it, and it's sort of alphabetical. So, you know, and you've got completely random stuff, like A is aluminium foil, because, you know, I use it nearly every day.
It's incredible and how much it's used. Let's see what you write about. What do you say about aluminium?
Okay, foil? I'll read you a little bit about what I say. Right, when Simon Hopkinson and I were working on roast chicken and other stories, our favourite lunch was baked potatoes, hummus and a jar of fearsomely hot chilli sauce. For speed, the potatoes were halved, the cuts I dipped into Maldon sea flakes, laid on a foil-lined roasting tin and put in the oven before it came up to temperature. Cooking them like this at the highest temperature my ailing little oven could muster, we weren't subject to tantalising cooking smells for more than 30 minutes. It is the foil, always laid shiny side up, that speeds up the cooking. Mm. Barely a day goes by for me without using foil for something in my kitchen, and I don't give it a second thought. Curious, though, to realise that it's been around for centuries, made initially from solid metal beaten or rolled to paper thinness. It gets the name tinfoil because the mass-produced stuff was made from tin, later replaced by aluminium. And it goes on and on.
I've never, ever thought about my tinfoil before, and that's fascinating.
And then it goes on about, you know, how I use it, and then...
Oh, she loves... You love Baco foil.
And Baco foil sheets.
Oh, what, are they like
you know,
separate
so,
ones?
Oh, yeah, ooh, separate sheets, and they're cut to the right size, and
ooh,
it's just heaven.
How exciting.
It is. I mean, it's pathetic how one does get excited by these things, actually. You know, my recipe for that is souffle jacket potatoes. And I reminisce about bonfire night when I was a child, where I lived. I was brought up in a place called Chislehurst.
Yes,
and,
in Kent.
In Kent.
Yeah.
And we lived, our house was on like a village green. It was just called
I
The
know
Common.
I know it, because
it's
you? Quite pretty there.
Yeah,
I've been to the caves. I went to an Andrew Logan party
Did you? Oh, wow. So our house backed onto the Tiger's Head, which you may have been to, and the very pretty church just
lovely.
There, St Nicholas Church.
Lovely.
So, you know, we would always every year have a bonfire. There'd be a big bonfire party, which my dad built, and everyone, all the houses around. My mother made baked potatoes for an army, you know, and so I'm talking about that.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about my way of getting ahead with jacket potatoes. She used to part cook them and then finish them off. You know, just before.
That's a good idea.
And it works perfectly.
Yeah.
On the fire or in the oven.
Yeah.
Hello,
yeah.
Red.
Oh, what, so it helps in the oven as well?
Yes, yes, yes. It speeds things up.
Oh.
But tinfoil speeds things up.
This is Red. Hello, Red. Red's a lurcher. Red's realised that I might like him. So.
Her.
Oh, sorry.
So then I'll talk about stuffing jacket potatoes. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lovely recipe for souffle jacket potatoes and
souffle, so they rise,
yeah,
do they?
Yeah, yeah.
Gosh,
yeah.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me your personal favourite in there.
Oh my lord, that's a really hard question. There's a wonderful tagine in here which is made in it is made by Le Creuset, but it doesn't look like it. It has a glass lid. It's a great big frying pan. I use that an awful lot, and it's perfect.
And how old is that? How
risotto. Long have you had it? It's not that old. I probably had it about 8 years.
Okay, I'll look out for that.
It's a really good
useful
thing.
Useful piece. Yeah,
I'll show you it. Mm. My toaster. I love my dual-lit toaster.
Oh, do you get on with those? Because I think you either do or you don't.
Yes,
you
know. I've had it. I mean, I tell the story of all the many toasters that I've nearly burnt the house down with. Yeah. And this one has, you know, that has lasted a long time, actually.
So, again, it's an investment, because they are a bit more.
But it is an investment, I've had to change the burners inside. And, in fact, I think you can buy a replacement.
See, I've always found them a bit tricky, because how do you know? Do you get to know it so well that you...
Yeah, I go into that in my whole thing about toasters. There's a whole essay about toasters. So you get a lot for your money with this book, actually.
So what I really want to ask you, actually, is because you were a restaurant critic, what's your favourite restaurant at the moment? Because it's so annoying when people say of all time, you know. Mm, where do you like that you've been to?
Oh, well, I'll tell you where I've just been to, actually. Mm. And so that would be my favourite, but it's not the sort of place that you want to go every week. Mm-hmm. And it's called Otto's. Mm. And it's in Gray's Inn Road, which is where Time Out used to be. And it's run by this chap called Otto, who I think used to work at Le Tour d'Argent in Paris. And the speciality is pressed duck. And that's what I heard. I went actually with Simon Hopkinson and another chef friend called Richard Shepherd, who used to run Langan's Brasserie. And in fact, all my lovely marble comes from the Coq d'Or, which is what Langan's Brasserie used to be way back in the day.
So you went and grabbed it when they were doing
restoring it. Yes, yeah, sort of. There's a story about that as well. And
what do you mean pressed duck? Is it
there's this special or very old-fashioned press, and the duck is pressed.
Before
it's literally pressed.
It's
after it's cooked, and it is. You know, the meal was absolutely amazing, and we ended up we had sweetbreads to start with.
What are sweetbreads?
Because they're the gland, aren't they?
I don't know. I don't know whether they're a rude bit of the animal. Or...
No, they're the gland.
Okay. Mama cried.
So Lindsay, being a perfectionist and a journalist and into detail, had to look it up. What sweetbread is? So what is it, Lindsay?
It says here. But the term sweetbreads is actually a benign-sounding pseudonym for the paired thymus glands and pancreas of milk-fed veal or calves. So there you are. The rounder pancreas gland near the heart is more prized than the tubular thymus throat gland.
I see. So it's like glands all over your body. So you can cut these off the animal and eat any bit of it, but it has to be a gland.
Yeah, there we go. So we've got that straight. They're creamy and very delicious, and particularly good when they are dusted in flour and fried, and then you have them with some kind of sauce that cuts through their rich creaminess.
And then you had the pressed duck.
Then we had the pressed duck.
What's the idea of a pressed duck? Sorry, I just wanted to ask, is it that it gets the fat out? What does it do?
Yeah, it gets the fat out, and you get these wonderful, wonderful juices. It's just sort of absolutely sublime, very, very tender.
Mm.
And then after that, what do we have with it? We had some beans, green beans, cooked with finely chopped garlic.
Mm.
And souffle potatoes. Have you ever had souffle potatoes?
No.
It's a chip that is cooked again in really hot oil, and they look like little pillows. They are amazing. And then for pudding, we had pancakes. Oh, what are they called? Crepe Suzette.
Well, I love it. It's so traditional.
I mean, it was a completely traditional meal. An awful lot of wine got drunk. I got there at about 10 to 1 and I finally got home about 8:30. It was one of those lunches.
It sounds brilliant.
And that was my one break in the middle of Lent. Oh. And it took me a week to recover from.
I bet.
And I don't know that I've actually lost the weight that I put on in that one meal. Because everything was just laden with booze and, butter and everything rich and gorgeous.
Lindsay Barham, it has been such good fun having you on Radio Gorgeous. And you are a natural storyteller.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming on.
My weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous. Listen anywhere, anytime.